nothing quite like some African tribal music to kick off your day. Well, if you're still in your pyjamas, well, that's your fault, not mine. But if you've got your nightie on, then you're okay. Hello, this is Julie Mullen and the K Cole Show. And I just thought something kind of sending a message out to everyone who adores poetry to say, come on, 9:20, it's Rebecca Gethin. You've got to be here to listen to her words and her poetry and obviously some chat, because I know she lives up on the moor, as far as I know, anyway. Let's have a little bit of bliss to follow the African theme. Takes me back to Glastonbury. I saw this band at the Chalice Well in Glastonbury, gosh, many moons ago now. But I think they are absolutely wonderful, and particularly like that song too. So hello, Totnes. How are you doing? The Bull is opening today. So if you want a cup of coffee or a fizzy glass of water, that's your place, because it's just down the way on the Rotherfold. And we can all sit outside. We're allowed. Wow. So I'm Julie Mullen. That's the cake shop door flying open. And in honour of Rebecca, we've got the most amazing cake of words. A cake of words. Colin Large has surpassed himself. For those of you who don't know, our Colin is the resident bubble monger, lives here in our bubble, and he is the sound engineer and official cake maker. So, wow to him. What a fantastic cake it is. I'll have to have a slice and give you the lowdown. So to all of those who turned on the woofers and tweeters on 102.5 FM Sound Art Radio, you are so welcome. So if you're in Dartington or Totnes and done the radio thing, then wowza. Or perhaps you are much further afield in Jakarta and you've gone online, or Manila, or in Moscow, or are you closer to home? Well, not that close, but you could be in Glasgow or Cambridge, or how about Oxford? Have you noted? I've done the Oxford and Cambridge thing. I've no idea why. I'm obviously balmy. Let us, on that note, have a bit of Dimitri. It's time, isn't it? We've got to be put in the mood for this day, this beautiful day in Devon. little glimpse of Dmitri Shostakovich and the Piano Concerto No. 2, preparing us for our 9:20 poet and novelist, Rebecca Gethin. I went snooping on the internet, as you do, prior to guests coming on the show, and found a wonderful review of her book called Vanishings. Absolutely splendiferous review, which I shall attempt to read. With sensitivity and linguistic panache, Rebecca Gethin's Vanishings takes the reader on a journey from Dartmoor to Shetland, conjuring from mud, wave, rock, leaf and stem an exhilarating range of endangered creatures. Though she engages with themes of transience and fragility, each animal, be it the better-known hedgehog and cuckoo, or the less familiar violet ground beetle and narrow-headed ant, is vividly present on the page. Her commitment to detail and scientific accuracy are impressive, yet there is a spiritual dimension to the poet's quest to glimpse these vulnerable creatures too. The otter wanders a territory filled with rosaries of kelp, while after an emphatic sighting of a hump-backed whale, the air's hymn, the sea a psalm, in counterpoint. The imaginary sound patterns and inventiveness of language in these poems are dazzling, and it goes on. But I think that's a fantastic review to tell you who is coming on this programme at 9:20. I'm really looking forward to chatting with Rebecca about more of her words and listening indeed to her poetry. So let's have a little bit of something different that I've found called Twa Corbies. Here we go.
Made so we may make
You're enjoying the mix-up of music. That was Twa Corbies and by the band Macbeth. I hope you're doing the jig, Totnes. Are you doing a little bit of a kick-up? Hope so. So this is the one of the breakfast programmes. I hope you've been listening to Mr. Peter Shuren on the full Totnes Breakfast Show. That's between 8 o'clock in the morning and 9. And then, and that's Monday through Friday. And then I follow in his footsteps doing the Kate Cole Show. So, yes, if you've just tuned in wanting to hear all about Rebecca, then, we're almost there. Let's have a little bit of Shotgun, shall we? Just to calm our nerves. Come on, George.
Homegrown alligator, see you later. Gotta hit the road, gotta hit the road. The sun ain't changing the atmosphere. Architecture unfamiliar, I could get used to this. Time flies by in the yellow and green. Stick around and you'll see what I mean. There's a mountain top that I'm dreaming of. If you need me, you know where I'll be. I'll be riding shotgun underneath the hot sun, feeling like a someone. I'll be riding shotgun underneath the hot sun, feeling like a someone. We're the south of the equator, navigator. Gotta hit the road, gotta hit the road. Deep sea diving round the clock, bikini bottoms, lager tops. I could get used to this. Time flies by in the yellow.
Okay, we actually have telephonic connection with our poet and novelist, Rebecca Gethin. Good morning, Rebecca.
Hello, Julie. Lovely to be with you today.
Where are you located in Devon, Rebecca?
We live on the edge of Dartmoor near Widdicombe in the Moor.
Oh, God.
And we can just walk onto the moor from where we live.
Isn't that just heaven? How long have you been located there? How long have you lived there?
We've lived in this village about 30-something years, and we've been in this house about 20-something years. And I always thought of myself as a floater about, having moved my first previous 30 years of my life a lot, and then suddenly I end up as a sticker.
We love you, sticker. We love it. Now, I've been having a bit of a snoop on your Facebook page, and so I have to immediately go to the photograph of you in the water in December, swimming, and I'm like, oh my God, how on earth? Rebecca, you must be made of something quite unearthly, something amazing, very strong, I would say.
Yes, but it's just a question of acclimatising and doing it. If you swim through the summer, you keep going, and then the water only gets cold little by little, so you get used to it little by little.
Okay.
I just haven't got to December. I was determined to carry on.
Well, I have great admiration for you. Tell me, does this actually affect creativity? Is one of the reasons you take to the water to sort of get into the mode of being in place to write poetry and your novels? And
Yes, it must do, because it does give me a great sense of well-being when I've got out, as well as a great sense of happiness, really.
Ooh.
And just I don't care about the world kind of feeling. And also getting in, you have to have some grit to get in.
You do.
Actually, you have to have some grit to get out, because it's sometimes the air temperature is colder than the water.
Wow. That sounds a little bit like the journey of a poet and a novelist, actually, this grit you're talking about. And clearly, I've been, as I say, hanging around your website this morning and having a look and going, oh my God, Rebecca Gethin just gets one book out after the next, after the next. You are quite prolific. So tell me, literally, going back a little bit to childhood, for instance, is there a piece you remember from your childhood that sort of has maybe propelled you forward in this world of writing? Was there a moment in your childhood you thought, I think I'm going to be a writer, or perhaps teachers told you this?
No, I was always going to be a writer. Mm. I don't know. I can't remember. I mean, the first time somebody asked me what I was going to do when I grow up, as people do with children, I said I was going to be a writer. And then I wasn't for a long time. But anyway, as a child, you then get people going, oh, yeah, right, okay, I see. And you realise later, kind of as a teenager, that it's probably not okay, it's not going to work. But I wrote loads of stories as a child, and I wrote poems, and I'd hide under the bedclothes and write stuff. So it was always there.
Yeah.
I can't remember, and I haven't got anything I wrote then.
No. I didn't expect you to have, but I'm just wondering.
I'd love to have a notebook with it in, but
wouldn't that be amazing?
In my very best handwriting, which was very bad. Yeah, and then I went and did an English degree at university because that was what I thought was the training for to be a writer. And actually, so much analysis meant that I couldn't even read a book for 10 years afterwards. Not even a printed word. Not even a newspaper.
God, isn't that incredible?
So it actually killed the writing bit in me. So that was sad.
That's quite shocking as well, isn't it?
It is a bit shocking, yes. Of course, it was very good training, but in the long run, I knew a lot of stuff. But yes, it did kill the creative impulses. I just got on with life and became a teacher, and then I did other things. So all through that time, I didn't write at all.
Tell me about the turning point when you began to realise you probably couldn't live without actually getting to activate your dream.
Yes, well, that was when I left it till I was 50. And at that point, or maybe just a bit before, but 50 was a turning point for me. It was like I walked through a gateway and I thought, I don't really care what other people think anymore. And at work, I was always given the reports to write because they all said, oh, she's good at writing. She can do those things. Well, that's the wrong side of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But it did also satisfy my writing first a bit. It was just to write any old thing. So I wrote reports, I wrote minutes, all that sort of thing. But at 50, I thought, I'm going to stop saying yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mind if they get cross with me about it. I'm going to stop saying yes. I'm going to write what I want. So then I hid behind the curtain, behind the sofa. I didn't want anyone to know I was writing because I felt really embarrassed about it. I thought I shouldn't waste my time. Very hard, actually, I think, for some women to admit they're writing because it does feel like time taken away from what you should be doing, i.e. working or being domestic. So I hid. And then I enrolled on an MA, which I didn't finish because I lost my job and I couldn't pay for it anymore. But I'd started an MA, and that gave me the chance to give myself permission to say to people, I am writing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened then. And after that, I came out of the closet. and actually not finishing the MA was one of the best things I ever did because it was very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't doing any poetry, having promised me they would at the beginning. And I thought, well, I'll just go on courses and I'll find out how to do it myself. So my determination got fired up. So I thought, I'm damn well going to do it without the MA. I don't need it.
Mm. You're very strong, Rebecca. They're very strong decisions. I really am pleased that you are so strong, because I think a lot of listeners out there on this journey, on the writing journey, will think, oh, no, well, I've started an MA. I have to complete it. And what you're saying is you chose not to for certain reasons. And you clearly exploded, because you are the most amazing poet and novelist and creative force. Tell me about that beginning journey and what really fired you up. Did you have people sort of affirming? I mean, clearly you have publishing houses who have, you know, taken you on, taken your work on. So that is such a strong affirmation anyway. But was it this, is it the kind of people taking you under their wing that got you really fired up in the end?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think it might be interesting for you to know that actually, if I hadn't had the apprenticeship in writing poetry, I'd never have written a novel.
That is interesting, yeah.
Which I can't really explain, but I think that the poetry taught me to look at the heart of things and to not to get rid of the extraneous stuff,
mm-hmm.
and cut out the little words. So I did, yeah, I just went on courses. I don't think anyone particularly helped me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I went on courses, and then I put a poetry book together and I sent it off to Oversteps Books, to the wonderful Alwyn Marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And much to my astonishment, she took it on, and that was called, it's the best thing about this book is the title is the A river is the plural of rain.
Mm.
Not a river. River is the plural of rain.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my first book. And then after that, I started writing this book, which I called Telling the Bees, a novel, which was set in Second World War Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was where my father had been a partisan, and I had been doing research into what it was like to be a partisan, and I was trying to find him. And strangely enough, of course, you can understand he was a partisan because I'm part Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And his father was Italian, and he was born and brought up in Italy, and then he ended up as a partisan, a bilingual partisan.
Mm-hmm.
So I was researching all that, and then I wrote my second novel. I had to give myself permission to write that, to fictionalise fact, if you see what I mean. So it was a historical mm-hmm. fiction, but it was quite fictional. And it was about two women who joined the partisans. And because I knew the area quite well, I was able to write it. But I couldn't have written it without the poetry.
So that's an interesting take on your career, because there'll be people out there who perhaps even haven't ventured forth into poetry. But I love it the way you describe that it allowed you to sort of come to the nitty gritty of what writing is about. It was, you know, it showed you the way, if you like. So can we actually hear some of your poetry this morning, please, Rebecca?
I decided I'd read this one. It's from a little book. I mean, little in that it's a few poems. It's like sort of 20 or so poems.
Mm-hmm.
And it's published by Three Drops Press. And it's called A Sprig of Rowan. And it's all about mythology and folklore.
Mm.
Because that's what Three Drops Press publish. So this book I was always very pleased with. I'm not very pleased with all my books, but I was very pleased with this one.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is called Dulcie Bridge. And it's set in Scotland, and it's true.
Mm-hmm.
So here is Dulcie Bridge. It's also the fairy's crossing point, where peaty waters of Findhorn moil through a gorge. To live near there, you needed to know how to lock your door. Mrs. Milne lived in the two-room cottage at Dulcie, her eyes as blue as the jay's lucky feather, her hair like light on thistledown. She knew how to lock her door with a sprig of rowan. When she met travellers on the road, she'd invite them to go right in and take a cup of her tea at her hearth, for she only locked her door with a sprig of rowan. She brought up 12 children, adopted another, and then discovered a newborn in a box on the mat, for she only locked her door with a sprig of rowan. And that's it.
Absolutely wonderful, Rebecca. That's so beautiful.
She said, she told me she wasn't afraid of people going in her house. She was only afraid of the fairies.
The sprig of rowan is so, what a concept, it's absolutely beautiful.
She really did. If she met someone on the road, she'd say, oh, go in my, I can't do a Scottish accent, go in my house and help yourself to a cup of tea.
I love her. I absolutely love her. And I love the fact that she's real.
Yes. And she was my friend for a while. So that was very special. So that's why I read that poem to you, because I rather love it.
Thank you. You know, when you said that you don't love all your books, tell me a little bit about the relationship with the books that you've made. Just to tie, I know we don't want to focus on that too much, but it was just really interesting for me to hear you say those words because...
Ah, yeah, well, I liked that book very much. And it was funny because a lot of writers, and it happens to me a lot too, is that if you're putting a collection of poems together, you can't decide in which order to put the poems.
Mm.
You could just throw them up in the air and they'd all fall down and you may as well do it that way. And then there's all sorts of various ways people tell you to organise it, like putting all your bits of paper out on the floor and seeing which poems speak to one another. This one I put together in 5 minutes because every poem I knew what came next.
That's amazing.
So that was a very lovely experience.
Very clear, isn't it?
Yes. It just felt, as you say, very clear, like clear water.
Yeah. But would you say that when you sit down to write, so where would that be? Is that a particular place for you, Rebecca, in your house, or is it outside? Or
yeah, I've got a desk in the spare room.
Yeah.
Sometimes we've got a summer house, and sometimes I write there.
Mm-hmm.
So I write in the mornings, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Except when it's really sunny and lovely, and I can't bear to be inside. And I've got gardening to do, or swimming to do. So I spend the morning writing, and I'll probably go over what I did yesterday or what I did last week. And then I'm sitting there, and at that point, I call it keeping the pencils sharp.
Mm.
If I'm not there at my desk, then I know that I'm not going to write anything new. So when I've done some editing, usually something new comes.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'll scribble that down and work on that over the next few days or week.
Are you absolutely tight about that kind of focus that it's each morning, obviously, unless the sun is shining or there's a bit of gardening to do? Are you actually really that disciplined that you'll go to your desk or the summer house?
Certainly, if I've got a project on, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I would treat it like a job.
Absolutely, yeah.
And no, I won't come out and do something unlikely.
You'll stick with it.
Yeah.
I love the story.
But sometimes when I, like right now, I haven't got a particular project I'm working on. I'm a bit more of a flibbertigibbet. So it's not, it's not cast in iron.
Yeah.
But
you give it some flexibility.
If I'm working towards something, then yes, I work every morning.
Shall we have some more poetry?
Okay, well, I'll read from my latest book then.
Okay.
Which is called Vanishings.
Mm.
It has a lovely picture of a pine marten climbing a tree at night on the front.
Wonderful.
And this book is all about endangered creatures of the UK. I didn't go worldwide. And the little rule I set myself was that I had to see everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it meant I could go travelling and I could ask questions and I could get experts to show me things. So that was rather fun. But anyway, this didn't require an expert.
Okay.
And this is seals, the Atlantic grey seal that's in... It overwinters on coves and beaches, safe cliff-high ones, you know, with cliffs all around, along the Atlantic coast.
Mm-hmm.
This was in Cornwall, actually. So you can imagine me watching the... There was about 100 seals down below me.
Wow.
And my feet were hanging over about a 100-foot drop of cliff.
God.
And there were two seals not sleeping. The rest were all asleep. And this is called The Secret Life of Seals. It starts with a breath huff, a nose push, a flipper touch, a lean towards, a smuggling, a belly up, a heaving over, a mutual slide along, sloping shingle into woof of bubble, in twirl squirm and fangy tango lunge, an almost dozy doe, a flippy tangle, a wrap, a bit of tag, a lot of tug, an ottering, a floating among breakers, a snorty swing out to the deep, a breakneck dash between rocks and knotted currents, diving into invisibility, rising nose to nose with oxter tingle, with flipper slapping laughter, waltzing with each other's tails, weightless, weightless.
Absolutely. This is what is described as linguistic panache. From one of your reviews. That was absolutely magnificent, Rebecca. Really, really wonderful.
Thank you very much.
I have to have a copy of that book. So basically, you and your career as a writer, as a novelist, as a poet, I loved the although it sounded a bit painful to have that journey of, you know, going to study English language and then not writing anything for 10 years, but you got there, and at 50, you said to yourself, I'm not taking it anymore. I'm doing really what I want to do. Love it. But along the way, you've been a teacher. It was that in creative writing or a poetry teacher? Or how did that, where was that placed?
Well, I was an English teacher to start with in a secondary school.
Mm-hmm.
And we did wonderful, crazy things. You couldn't do it these days. I used to take the children out. For instance, we were doing, I don't know, we were investigating Chinese literature or something, and we wanted to look at dragons, and I said that the hills around, it was at Columpton, the hills were all formed, looked like dragons, didn't they? So we all went out and looked how hills were formed like dragons, and that's where the idea of dragons came from. It was probably landscape features. And we did things like that. And then we'd look out the window and there was a funny piece of farm machinery outside, the sort of thing that, I don't know, it was funny, it had a funny shape. So, again, it looked like a dragon or it looked like something, so I got the kids writing about that sort of stuff. This is all before a national curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a bit of a mad teacher.
I love you.
And I taught drama too. And one day I turned up wearing a hat and a cloak and I said nothing. And this was quite a naughty class. I said nothing at all and just sat there. And they were all saying, you're supposed to teach us! Get on with it, miss!
Oh, that's so, funny.
Anyway, I couldn't keep it up for very long because actually they were getting quite naughty. And that room was just above the staff room. So, I had to create some order.
Of course.
It was quite an interesting experiment that they wanted me to teach.
That's a terrific experiment. I really wish you'd been my teacher. I really want you to be my teacher. Rebecca...
Actually, that lot, when I left that school, they bought me a puppy, a real live puppy.
Oh, my God!
And again, you couldn't do that these days. They said they were going to do this because they knew I wanted one. I don't know how they did, but they knew I did. And I found a litter of puppies I wanted to have a puppy from, and I took a deputation from the class. They decided who would come. Four of them came in my car at lunchtime, and we went, and I said, I like that puppy. Is that all right? And they said, yes, miss, yes, yes, you can have that one. And then on my last day in that school, I took that puppy into school. Everybody laughed. It was such fun. None of that would happen these days.
No, no, it wouldn't. I think it's time for another poem. I love that story.
Okay. So, I think I'll read something. This one is from a little book, which I feel I'm sort of quite happy with, but also it just has to be what it is, because I wrote it. And then I said, I'm not touching it, ever. I'm not editing it, I'm not doing anything. And I got a month's residency in a castle in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to write. And I didn't cook. And all the food was given to you, and a little basket of lunch arrived at your door in a little hamper, and you couldn't speak between 9:30 and 6. And I spent that month working on the letters that I had just been given by a cousin from my mother when she was dying in hospital when I was 2. Mm-hmm. And he gave me these letters 60 years later. And they were little letters, scrappy letters written on sort of that lined, thin letter writing paper. And so then I investigated the letters to try and work out what my mother was like. So I'll just read you this poem. And the title is "Want Was a Word Forbidden by My Grandmother." But my mother writes, I can't help wanting things to be otherwise. Such a fat little mole of a word to signify lack. It burrows out its winding passages within you, throws up want hills. It wants so much from you because wanting always wants more and yet more. Starting as a thought, it grows in your vitals. The flip side of its meaning is to wane and to waste, but what my mother really didn't want was to be found wanting.
Oh.
And I noticed my mother used this word want, you see.
Mm.
But when I was a child, her mother, my grandmother, used to tell me off very sternly for using the word want. I was never allowed to say, I want some more.
Oh.
Or I want Marmite, or I want chocolate biscuits. I was only able to say, please, can I have, or I would like.
Isn't that interesting? In fact, I have this book, right, the book that you just read from, All the Time in the World, right in front of me. I went searching this morning, and I see it's by Cinnamon Press, and you have a lovely little words on the back, one by, these are brave, honest, and deeply touching poems. And in them, Rebecca Gethin has achieved a remarkable portrait of the mother she mourns. But it's a very emotional book. It's absolutely beautiful. And when you say that you literally wrote it and then you never went back to it, it had arrived, it was there. I completely understand that. Completely. Mm. Yeah.
I do tend to work on things, but when I left the castle, it was like a magic spell got broken. And I thought, I'll never change any of those poems. And if nobody likes them, then nobody likes them. But that's how they are. So I wasn't going to change them for what a publisher said.
No, why should you? I love the one, Always Singing. So your mother used to sing a lot, did she?
Yeah, she used to train with Julie Andrews and was considered better.
Wow. Gosh, isn't that amazing?
I didn't hear her sing because I don't remember.
No, you were two.
I mean, there are two occasions in the book when I do. People say you don't remember before three.
Mm.
But there are two occasions in the book when I do remember her. But anyway, I don't remember her singing, but I wrote that because I bet she did sing a lot.
Mm. Yeah. So how many poetry books have you actually written?
It sounds ridiculous, but six.
Six poetry books.
One, I mean, you know, that All the Time in the World and The Sprig of Rowan are pamphlets.
Yeah.
And the latest one is even tinier,
mm-hmm.
and that's called Fathom. And that's very tiny. That's about 10 poems. And that was written because I got a residency in far west Penwith, Cape Cornwall, and I got 2 weeks. And I spent most of the time staring at the sea and thinking, I'm not writing anything. But actually, I must have done, because a little book came out of it.
Amazing. I bet that's quite scary, to be in situation.
Well, it was, because it was also in December.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite my choice, but that's what they gave me. On my own, on the end of Cape Cornwall, which, if you happen to know where it is, it's extremely remote. And I was the last house on the end of the point. It was a force 12 gale one night.
God.
12!
God.
So you could barely stand up.
Yeah.
But anyway, the sea was very dramatic.
I bet it was. I think we're slightly running out of time, so let's have another poem before we conclude.
Okie dokie. I think I'm going to read you... sorry, running out of time. I'm going to read you a poem about a nightjar.
Mm.
And it comes from Vanishings. And a nightjar is a lovely bird that comes from Africa and comes to parts of probably lots of places, but there's quite a few places on Dartmoor.
Mm-hmm.
Just because a bird is common in one place, it doesn't mean it's common across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So the nightjars can be found on Dartmoor and other places,
mm-hmm.
many other places, but they're not common. And they're very beautiful, and they only fly at night.
Wow.
And they make this amazing noise.
Mm.
And I'll try and get you the noise up. Okay. I did do that before all the shenanigans happened. Actually, shall I just play you the... Have I got time?
Yes, do.
Sound?
Absolutely.
In case people don't know it.
Yes, I'd love to hear it.
Half a ticket's coming.
Don't worry. Yes, I did. It was amazing.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So one of my favourite things in June, July, is to go out and hear it. But anyway, I got taken. As I said, this book enabled me to get into places I wouldn't otherwise done, by one of the bird ringers on an expedition, and he let me hold one.
Gosh.
And you won't know that from listening to the poem, so that's why I'm telling you.
Mm.
It's a very amazing thing. It is a hawk. It's called a night hawk as well.
Mm-hmm.
Holding the night. Its body is all feather and bone. I bring it close, wrapping my fingers over its wings. My fingertips answer its bounding heart, as if together they created vibrato. It weighs almost nothing. A ribcage enclosing the inner life. Air between wing coverts, silks rubbing. With one wrong squeeze, it might shatter into birds. I could fall into the gaping beak, vanish in the pink gullet. Eyes reflect glints of star. The moon has thumbed its name on wing and tail. Flight is a living thing. Only by being so light can it fly so far and carry the dark.
Wow. Thank you so much, Rebecca. It has been an absolute pleasure being with you, and I've learned so much about you. And
I've learned things about myself.
And I absolutely loved hearing all of your stories and your words. And thank you for being on Sound Art 102.5 FM this morning with us.
It's been a great honour and a lovely experience. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
We managed it. We got her on the phone. That was absolutely incredible. What a talent that woman is. An incredible talent. So I will flag up her address, obviously not where she lives, but the internet one, so you can seek her out and buy her books. I definitely want to get her latest one and The Vanishings. Here is Gabriel's oboe to take us to the hour. Just want to thank Rebecca Gethin again. Thank you, Rebecca, for coming on 102.5 FM Sound Art Radio. You can get more information about Rebecca's work at, let me just quieten this music a little bit, Rebecca Gethin, that's spelt G-E-T-H-I-N. So, RebeccaGethin.wordpress.com. So do go and have a little look. Some amazing reviews of Rebecca's work really say it all, really. I think I read one earlier and it basically encapsulated her incredible gifts as a poet and also novelist. So we'll be back tomorrow. Please tune in. We have Rosie Jackson, poet, and our poet in residence, Liv Talk. So we'll see you then. Let's have a little bit of that drumming sound again to take us to the hour.